You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. My name is Frank Rose, and I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings. Thanks for joining us for this morning's program on the future of U.S. extended deterrence. And we have a great program this morning to explore a very important but extremely complicated national security issue. Our program this morning will consist of two parts. First, we'll kick off the event with a keynote address by David Trachtenberg, the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, who will outline the Trump administration's approach to extended deterrence. Secretary Trachtenberg's address will be followed by a panel discussion with three distinguished experts in the field to explore the issues in greater detail. On that note, it is my distinct honor and pleasure to welcome Mr. David Trachtenberg, the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, back to Brookings. Secretary Trachtenberg has more than 35 years of experience in working in the private sector, the executive branch, and the legislative branches of government. Immediately prior to assuming his current position in October 2017, Secretary Trachtenberg served as President and Chief Executive Officer of Short Waiver Consulting, LLC, a national security consultancy. But this is not the first time he has served at the Pentagon. From 2001 to 2003, Secretary Trachtenberg was the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy, where he was my boss. In addition to his work at the Department of Defense in the private sector, he's also served on the House Armed Services Committee as a professional staff member. Secretary Trachtenberg will provide about 20 to 25 minutes of opening remarks. Following that, he's kindly agreed to take some questions from the audience. So therefore, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Deputy Undersecretary of Defense David Trachtenberg.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. And thank you, Frank, very much for the kind introduction. I appreciate the invitation to be here, Frank. I appreciate the invitation to come back to Brookings and speak with you today on a topic that is very important to discuss, although this is a fine spring day, and I'm sure we'd all rather be talking about other things than nuclear weapons issues on a nice spring day like today. Nevertheless, I'm pleased to be here, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity to exchange views on this important subject. I had a professor at Georgetown once who taught these particular issues, and his one regret was that he didn't teach a course in art history, because he thought art history was a lot more uplifting than this subject matter, which I fully understand. But notwithstanding that, I've been asked to discuss the future of extended deterrence, and put simply, because it is a complex issue. Put simply, when we talk about extended deterrence, we are talking about the ability to prevent adversary aggression against our friends and allies by extending our protection to them. And this includes the protection offered by our nuclear forces, which is why extended deterrence is often sort of colloquially referred to as U.S. nuclear umbrella. It's a way of assuring allies that the United States has their back and is committed to their security. So what I'd like to do is put this ongoing and long-standing U.S. commitment in context. First, I would like to give a brief overview of the security environment as described in the National Defense Strategy and the Nuclear Posture Review. Then I'd like to spend a few minutes talking a bit about central deterrence, in particular the relevance and importance of our nuclear modernization program as the foundation upon which we build our extended deterrence commitment to allies. Then I'll give some thoughts on the allied perspective, and then sort of sum up by addressing the continued importance of our constructive ambiguity doctrine and why a no-first-use policy with respect to nuclear weapons really is not called for in today's environment. So as far as the broader context goes, the 2018 National Defense Strategy rightly describes today's security environment as more complex, volatile, and dangerous than any in recent memory. Today, the principal issue facing the Department is the eroding U.S. military advantage vis-a-vis China and Russia. For years, our competitors have developed military concepts and capabilities intended to make it more difficult and costly for the United States to intervene in the defense of our allies, partners, and interests. The conventional force dominance that we have enjoyed for decades has created an incentive for our competitors not only to upgrade their own conventional military forces, but to rely more heavily on nuclear weapons in their strategies as a way of asymmetrically offsetting our conventional force advantages. Russia and China have both strengthened, and North Korea has developed the ability to threaten or use nuclear weapons as a means of challenging the West and overturning the established international order that the United States helped create after World War II. Disturbingly, this includes an apparent increased willingness by Russia to contemplate the limited use of nuclear weapons, as evidenced by Russian leadership statements, military exercises, and nuclear force investments. These investments include the modernization of Russia's large number of non-strategic or so-called tactical nuclear weapons, and the deployment of a ground launch cruise missile in clear violation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty. Thus, maintaining the efficacy of nuclear deterrence is as important today as it has ever been. While the reemergence of great power competition makes extended deterrence more critical and arguably more challenging than ever before. Now, in committing to defend NATO members in Europe and our allies in Asia, the United States helps deter would-be aggressors from attempting to leverage their expanded and modernized nuclear capabilities to alter the existing political, territorial, and security arrangements. We understand that the security environment has changed and that nuclear threats are more prevalent for our allies today than they have been in years, and that as a result, allies feel new anxieties. To this end, the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review not only emphasized the importance of extended deterrence to achieving U.S. objectives, but went further to clarify that the assurance of allies and partners is one of the four explicit roles for U.S. nuclear weapons. This assurance role, in combination with the role of deterring both nuclear and non-nuclear attack against the United States, its allies and partners, reflects an ongoing U.S. policy commitment to the continued importance of extended nuclear deterrence in our strategy. Now, at this point, I think it's important to note that the United States cannot credibly extend nuclear deterrence unless it can ensure its own security with some degree of confidence. Thus, I would argue, extended deterrence does not exist in a vacuum. Rather, the credibility of extended deterrence hinges on the robustness and reliability of central deterrence, that is, namely, the continued effectiveness of our strategic nuclear forces. So there's a clear linkage between our central strategic forces and the credibility and reliability of our nuclear umbrella. As a recent article co-authored by a Brookings senior fellow named Frank Rose recently stated, quote, "America's nuclear capabilities underpin its key alliances and are a crucial bulwark against growing Russian and Chinese regional aggression." Now, to this end, the NPR's tailored deterrence strategy, underpinned by flexible nuclear capabilities, is intended to ensure that potential adversaries do not miscalculate regarding the consequences of their nuclear threats or actual nuclear use. The 2018 NPR, consistent with the findings of all previous nuclear posture reviews produced by both Republican and Democratic administrations, endorsed the nuclear triad as the most cost-effective and strategically sound structure for ensuring effective deterrence. The triad, of course, is the combination of land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, sea-based or sea-launched ballistic missiles, and strategic bombers on which our ultimate deterrent rests. The triad's synergies and complementary attributes, for example, the reliability and dispersion of our land-based missile force, the survivability of our sea-based platforms, and the flexibility of our bombers, has served us well for decades and provide the mix and range of capabilities needed to continue effective deterrence in today's dynamic security environment. Given the breadth of the roles of nuclear weapons identified in the Nuclear Posture Review and the diverse and dynamic threats the United States faces in the 21st century, it's imperative that the United States possess a diverse range and mix of nuclear forces to enable us to tailor deterrence to unique adversary characteristics and objectives. But the triad we have today is now operating far beyond its originally planned service life. In fact, over the past 25 years, the United States has made only relatively modest investments in basic nuclear sustainment, life extension, and operations. Most of the nation's nuclear delivery systems on which we rely for deterrence were built in the 1980s or even earlier. And despite multiple efforts to keep them functional long beyond their originally intended lifespan, we cannot keep them operational and reliable in perpetuity. So if not recapitalized, modernized, upgraded, these forces will simply age into obsolescence. That is not an acceptable outcome. Therefore, consistent with the approach taken by the prior administration, the fiscal year 2020 budget request funds all critical Department of Defense modernization requirements, helping to ensure that modernization or that modern replacements will be available before the nation's legacy systems reach the end of their extended service lives. Our DOD budget for the request for nuclear forces is about $25 billion, which sounds like an awful lot of money, and of course it is, but it is only roughly 3.5% of the overall Department of Defense budget, relatively small fraction. And this includes about $8 billion for recapitalization programs. Recapitalization programs include the B-21 bomber, the ground-based strategic deterrent, intercontinental ballistic missile, the long-range standoff cruise missile, as well as the Columbia-class nuclear ballistic missile submarine. Also includes slightly more than $16 billion to sustain and operate our nuclear forces. This expenditure is both necessary and affordable. As a relative share of the DOD budget, our planned spending on nuclear modernization at the height of the modernization program will not exceed 7%. This is still less in percentage terms than the major modernization efforts that took place in the 1960s and in the 1980s. But more importantly, because our nuclear forces are the ultimate guarantor of our security, it's dangerous to assume we can guarantee deterrence on the cheap. Although maintaining the efficacy of our nuclear triad requires a significant and a sustained level of investment, I would argue the costs of sustaining an effective nuclear deterrent are far less than the cost of failing to do so. As the bipartisan National Defense Strategy Commission stated in its recent review, we believe that the 2018 NPR offers an appropriate option for meeting U.S. nuclear deterrence and assurance requirements in this era of major power rivalry, and we urge DOD to proceed along the path the NPR lays out. Our extended deterrence posture depends on the credibility of central deterrence, and this, in turn, depends on the successful completion of our modernization program. Now, extended deterrence poses a more complex set of challenges for the United States than central deterrence for several reasons. And, for example, the United States must possess deterrence capabilities that are credible from the adversary's perspective, with credibility being a function of both U.S. capability and the will to exercise that capability. In essence, the will to go to war, possibly nuclear war, in the defense of others. In addition, the U.S. commitment must be viewed as credible by our allies who we are seeking to defend, and their views regarding the credibility of our security guarantees to them may differ. For example, our Asian allies may have a different view of what it takes to assure them of our security commitment than our European allies. And even our European allies may hold different views among themselves. Finally, of course, in the unlikely event that deterrence fails, hopefully unlikely event, obtaining and maintaining domestic support to actually employ nuclear weapons on behalf of an ally may be particularly challenging, especially if doing so exposes the U.S. homeland to a devastating counterstrike. Therefore, missile defenses also have an important role to play in bolstering the credibility of our extended deterrent. So, what are we doing from an extended deterrence perspective to credibly assure our allies? Well, first, the National Security Strategy provides a clear commitment to allies, noting in part that together with them, we can successfully deter and, if necessary, defeat aggression against U.S. interests and increase the likelihood of managing competitions without violent conflict. Follow-on guidance reflected in the National Defense Strategy directs both that we take steps to build a more lethal force and strengthen our allies and partners by expanding regional consultative mechanisms and collaborative planning in order to create an extended network capable of deterring or decisively acting to meet the shared challenges of our time. In addition, both the Nuclear Posture Review and the Missile Defense Review describe the importance of allies and partners to U.S. national security and the central role played by both nuclear and missile defense capabilities in extended deterrence. Now, while my remarks are focused on nuclear extended deterrence, it's important to reiterate that missile defense does contribute to deterrence, deterring both threats to the homeland and to our regional allies and partners by undermining a potential adversary's confidence in his ability to achieve his desired political or military objectives. The uncertainty this creates about the success of an adversary's actions, coupled with the knowledge that the United States has the ability to respond with a counterattack of its own, should make an adversary think twice about launching missiles against the United States or our allies or partners. As such, missile defense directly supports U.S. extended deterrence guarantees. With regard to Europe, the U.S. commitment to NATO is unwavering. A strong, cohesive nuclear alliance is the most effective means of deterring aggression and promoting peace and stability in the Euro-Atlantic region. And our extended deterrent is a demonstration of our commitment to maintaining the security of the alliance. Importantly, NATO is addressing the changed security environment to make clear that any employment of nuclear weapons against NATO, however limited, would not only fundamentally alter the nature of a conflict, but would result in unacceptable costs to an adversary that would far outweigh the benefits it could hope to achieve. Since the 2014 Wales summit, NATO has initiated measures to ensure that its overall deterrence and defense posture, including its nuclear forces, remains capable of addressing any potential adversary's doctrine and capabilities. This draws on NATO's long-standing commitment to adapt its posture to changes in the security environment. While many of NATO's specific nuclear adaptation efforts remain classified, the United States has publicly demonstrated its commitment to the alliance by extending the life of the B-61 gravity bomb, a stance that was reaffirmed in the 2018 NPR. The B-61-12 gravity bomb will replace earlier versions of the B-61, will have a lower yield and better accuracy than earlier variants. The United States is also incorporating nuclear capability onto the F-35A aircraft to be used by the United States and several NATO allies as a replacement for the current aging dual-capable aircraft. Current U.S. dual-capable aircraft able to deliver that weapon include the F-15E. Several NATO allies also provide aircraft capable of delivering U.S. nuclear weapons forward deployed to Europe. So improved aircraft readiness and the arrival of the fifth generation F-35 in conjunction with the B-61 gravity bomb will preserve NATO's ability to contribute to regional deterrence and assurance. While the foregoing efforts are focused on NATO, the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review also announced two supplemental U.S. nuclear capabilities intended to deny regional adversaries the mistaken confidence that any limited nuclear employment can provide a useful advantage over the United States and its allies and partners. This initiative was largely based on Moscow's perception that its greater number and variety of non-strategic nuclear systems may provide it with a coercive advantage in crises and at lower levels of conflict. Thus, the NPR concluded that the United States must adapt its existing forces with two modest supplemental capabilities to ensure that Russia, China, and others do not perceive an exploitable gap in our regional deterrence posture. The goal of these supplements is to discourage adversaries from even contemplating limited nuclear attacks, thereby strengthening deterrence and helping to prevent conflict in the first place. By modifying a small number of existing sea-launched ballistic missile warheads to provide a low-yield option, and by restoring a modern nuclear sea-launched cruise missile to the force, the U.S. will have credible response options to nuclear attacks of any magnitude. The low-yield sea-launched ballistic missile and nuclear-armed sea-launched cruise missile are measured responses to close troubling gaps in regional deterrence that have emerged in recent years. In addition, redeploying a sea-launched cruise missile addresses the enormous disparity in non-strategic nuclear forces without attempting to match Russia system for system. That is not our goal, and we are not attempting to match Russia system for system. General Scaparotti said in testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee in March, and I'll quote him, "Russia's non-strategic nuclear weapons stockpile is of concern because it facilitates Moscow's mistaken belief that limited nuclear first use, potentially including low-yield weapons, can provide Russia a coercive advantage in crises and at lower levels of conflict. The 2018 Nuclear Posture Review calls for adjustments to U.S. nuclear forces to close this perceived gap on the escalation ladder and reinforce deterrence against low-yield nuclear use." So both of these supplemental capabilities will complement our existing capabilities by providing assured, tailored options in the face of increasingly advanced air and missile defenses. In addition, the unique attributes of a nuclear sea-launched cruise missile may incentivize Russia to accept constraints on its non-strategic nuclear capabilities. These two supplements do not require nuclear testing, do not violate any arms control treaties or other international obligations, and they do not lower the threshold for nuclear use. Rather, they are intended to raise Russia's threshold for employing nuclear weapons by convincing Russia that it would gain no advantage by using low-yield nuclear weapons or engaging in limited nuclear strikes. Now, over the last 10 years, allies in Europe and Asia have become much more engaged in discussions with us on extended deterrence issues. We have dedicated and regularly occurring deterrence dialogues with these allies, which is useful for emphasizing the continued importance of U.S. extended deterrence commitments. Despite all the challenges that go with maintaining effective and credible nuclear deterrence, the alliance still values the U.S. extended deterrence commitment. As NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg said at the Munich Security Conference last year, "A world where Russia, China, and North Korea have nuclear weapons, but NATO does not, is not a safer world. That is why the ultimate guarantee of NATO's security is the strategic nuclear forces of allies, particularly those of the United States." And both the 2016 and 2018 NATO summit declarations reaffirm the importance of U.S. nuclear weapons and dual-capable aircraft contributions to NATO. Last year, the Brussels summit declaration explicitly stated, "NATO's deterrence posture relies on United States' nuclear weapons forward deployed in Europe and the capabilities and infrastructure provided by allies concerned." Russia's increasingly aggressive posture in recent years has not gone unnoticed by our European allies, highlighting the continued need for a credible U.S. extended deterrent. And in Asia, China's efforts to expand its influence, enhance its military reach, and develop its regional nuclear capabilities is a cause of concern for our partners in the Indo-Pacific region. In Japan, strong public antipathy to nuclear weapons remains a challenge for U.S. extended deterrence. However, the United States and Japan have for years engaged in a regular extended deterrence dialogue that has informed and elevated each nation's understanding and insights as to the U.S. commitment. In South Korea, uncertainty surrounding progress on denuclearization may foster concerns over the implications of the U.S.-North Korea dialogue for extended deterrence. However, during the 50th U.S. Republic of Korea Security Consultative Meeting, then Secretary of Defense Mattis and Minister of National Defense Zhang noted that U.S. forces in South Korea played a critical role in maintaining peace and security on the Korean Peninsula over the past 65 years and reiterated the U.S. commitment to maintain the force levels necessary to defend South Korea. In these ways, the transatlantic and trans-Pacific alliances face quite similar challenges posed by major power neighbors who have prepared to achieve something of a fait accompli at the conventional level of war and to expand the scope, scale, and intensity of conflict if the U.S. and its allies attempt to reverse that fait accompli. Another issue that has implications for the continued viability of our extended deterrent is the issue of no first use of nuclear weapons. Let me state at the outset here that U.S. declaratory policy on this issue increases the credibility of our commitment that we are prepared to employ nuclear weapons if necessary on behalf of allies and partners. The United States has a well-established policy of calculated ambiguity regarding U.S. nuclear employment that has long deterred potential adversaries from nuclear coercion or aggression. It's a bipartisan policy, reiterated in some form or fashion by every presidential administration since the early days of the nuclear era. Notably, in 2009, the bipartisan Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, led by former Secretaries of Defense William Perry and James Schlesinger, considered whether the United States should adopt a policy of no first use of nuclear weapons and concluded that the United States, quote, should not abandon calculated ambiguity by adopting a policy of no first use, end quote. This policy pronouncement was right then, and it continues to be right today. A policy of no first use would damage the health of our alliances because it could call into question the assurance in the eyes of our allies and partners that the United States will come to their defense in extreme circumstances. For NATO, neither the United Kingdom nor France have the full range of capabilities and associated options that the United States possesses. They cannot replace U.S. guarantees. Our Asian allies rely substantially on U.S. nuclear forces for their deterrence needs. And the adoption by the U.S. of a no first use policy could incentivize others to develop their own nuclear weapons, which would seriously undermine our nonproliferation policy. In fact, I would argue that our current policy is one of the greatest disincentives to nuclear proliferation today. Conventional forces are also unlikely to provide the same deterrent effect as nuclear weapons, as they may not be able to hold at risk those assets that an adversary values most, or they may not be positioned to respond in a timely enough manner to deter aggression in vital regions. Moreover, allies might feel the need to recalibrate how accommodating they might have to become to protect their interests in the face of nuclear-armed adversaries. Adoption of a no-first-use policy would also cause U.S. declaratory policy to diverge from our UK and French counterparts, a significant fissure within the NATO alliance that potential adversaries could seek to exploit. Such a policy could embolden adversaries to test what they might perceive as a weakened US resolve to defend our allies and interests with every means at our disposal. This could simplify the decision calculus of potential adversaries and actually undermine the deterrent effect of our nuclear forces. Despite the apparent attractiveness to some of a no-first-use policy, no presidential administration has seen it necessary or wise to abandon the tradition of calculated ambiguity that has served us well for decades. Given the security environment we currently face, as articulated in the National Defense Strategy, the NPR, and the Missile Defense Review, this is simply not the time to consider such a significant break from longstanding bipartisan precedent. So, in summary, let me say both the National Security Strategy and the National Defense Strategy released by this administration have emphasized the continuing importance of our allies and our alliances to the security of the United States. In turn, both the Nuclear Posture Review and the Missile Defense Review reinforce the importance of extending deterrence to our allies and partners. The bottom line is that extended deterrence reinforces the security relationships we have with allies. It sends a strong message of unity to potential adversaries, and it contributes to our non-proliferation goals and objectives. We are therefore committed to ensuring the continued viability of extended deterrence. By continuing the nuclear modernization programs begun under the previous administration, by continuing and expanding on the extended deterrence dialogues that we currently conduct with our treaty allies, by refining and clarifying U.S. declaratory policy as described in the Nuclear Posture Review, and by pursuing critical, though modest, supplements to our existing triad of nuclear forces, the low-yield ballistic submarine-launched ballistic missile and the sea-launched cruise missile. These efforts underscore that nuclear deterrence remains the bedrock of U.S. national security. The U.S. nuclear deterrent must dissuade any adversary from mistakenly believing it can benefit from any use of nuclear weapons, even in a limited way, against the United States or its allies and partners. Our nuclear deterrent underwrites all U.S. military operations and diplomacy around the globe. It is the backstop and foundation of our national defense. So in an era of renewed great power competition, allies and partners should take comfort in knowing that the United States has the will and the flexible, resilient nuclear capabilities needed to deter nuclear attack and coercion against us as well as against them. Let me conclude just by thanking Brookings for the opportunity to come here today, present the department's views, and discuss these issues. They're critically important to our national security. And with that, I'll be happy to take questions. So thank you all very much. Okay.
Hello, Secretary Trachtenberg. Thank you for taking the questions. My name is Dan Leone. I'm a reporter with Defense Daily. I had a question actually about the Department of Energy, which is building a couple of facilities to make the triggers for the future GBSD warheads. Both the Armed Services Committees have paled a little bit about the cost of doing two facilities and said, why not do one? So I wondered whether the DOE had given you any assurance that they can meet the timetable for the GBSD rollout if Congress limits them to one facility for these plutonium triggers.
That's a great question for my colleagues at the Department of Energy, who I wish were here and would be better able to address that. I'm aware of the issue, but I wouldn't want to sort of step on my colleagues' toes by addressing the details of that. So I'll defer on that one for the time being, at least.
Thank you, Secretary. In Jung Cho with the Voice of America. If you could comment on the North Korean threat. North Korea tested new tactical weapon last week. And are there any signs that North Korea is advancing its military capabilities? And how is DOD currently preparing for a possible provocation by North Korea at a time when diplomacy is at a standstill? Thank you.
Sure. Good question. We hope there will not be a provocation that the North Koreans will engage in. We are, of course, on the one hand, cautiously hopeful that the dialogue that we have engaged in with North Korea, that President Trump has engaged in with Kim Jong-un, will lead to very positive development ultimately in the full, complete denuclearization of North Korea. At the same time, we are certainly mindful. We are approaching these discussions and have been approaching these discussions with our eyes wide open. We're certainly mindful of the capabilities that North Korea has produced. We're mindful of the threat that North Korea poses, not only directly to the United States, but to our regional friends and allies as well. So we're hoping for the best. We are certainly not there yet. But we also understand that while North Korea has refrained from nuclear tests and ballistic missile tests for quite some time, we certainly understand that the capabilities that, that North Korea possesses still exist and still pose threats that we need to deal with. That was certainly one of the reasons why in our missile defense review we placed some significant emphasis on missile defense capabilities, not just to defend the homeland, but regional defense capabilities as well. So we can be hopeful, but at the same time, we are and need to continue to look at the ongoing situation with our eyes wide open, fully recognizing that there is a history there as well that we need to keep in mind.
Hello, Secretary Trachtenberg. Mark Buckman from the National War College. Thank you for your comments today and for taking questions. My question has to do with progress on the low-yield W-76 warhead. Can you tell us anything about what the United States has done so far or is in the process of doing, and does the administration feel that it needs Congress's permission to go forward with that?
We've certainly made clear what we intend to do to the Congress. The Congress is aware of our plans on both the supplemental capabilities that I mentioned. With respect to the low-yield ballistic missile warhead, we're moving forward to do that. And again, I would reemphasize what we're doing is not developing a new nuclear weapon. What we are basically doing is we are taking an existing nuclear weapon and we are modifying it in a way such that the yield of that weapon is reduced. I have found it a little bit interesting because certainly some of the critics of what we are doing have been arguing against a low-yield ballistic missile option on the grounds that it may make nuclear war or nuclear weapons more usable. That is certainly not our intent, and I would argue it has just the opposite effect. It makes nuclear weapons less usable from the standpoint of an adversary perspective. But I'd also argue that some of the critics of our plan to lower the yield of those ballistic missile warheads have also been critical of what they have seen as the high yields and the high explosive power and destructiveness of the current nuclear arsenal. So on the one hand, there are critics who argue we have too much destructive power in our nuclear arsenal, but on the other hand, our efforts to sort of lower the destructive potential of our weapons are also being criticized as making nuclear weapons more usable. I think those positions are internally inconsistent, and in fact, I see what we are doing with respect to the low-yield ballistic missile as a means, as I said, removing any misperceptions that an adversary might have, that they have some kind of exploitable advantage allows them to take more risks, engage in nuclear coercion, or actually to engage in aggression, even conventional aggression, because they feel they have a capability on the nuclear side that the United States doesn't have, or that the United States would be forced to take an action that could immediately escalate a conflict to a level that we certainly don't want to go down.
Hi, my name is Sang Min. I'm a reporter from the Radio Free Asia. I have one more question about North Korea. You mentioned that U.S. maintained formal extended deterrence dialogue with the Republic of Korea. So I want to know what kind of the discussion has been made during the this dialogue with the Republic of Korea, and then what is the U.S. Specific extended deterrence policy against North Korea?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of that question.
Okay. So you have been maintaining dialogue with ROK about the extended deterrence policy against North Korea. So can you tell me specifically what have you been discussed about that? So what is the U.S. extended deterrence policy against North Korea threat?
No, we have been maintaining a dialogue with the Republic of Korea. That dialogue is ongoing. We talked to the Republic of Korea when we developed the nuclear posture review. We made sure that we were aligned and that the Republic of Korea, as well as our other allies, of course, regionally, were aware of where we were going, what we were recommending, and why we were proposing to do that. I think it's been a robust dialogue all along. I think it's been a productive dialogue all along. We are, of course, aware of concerns with respect to North Korea and their programs and the threat North Korea capabilities pose. But I think overall, I have to say the dialogue, the consultations, and the relationship that we've had with our allies on these particular issues that we are talking about here has not only been very robust, I think it's been very well received by our allies and partners. And, you know, this is not sort of a one-and-done opportunity here. We continue to engage in a variety of forums on this and other issues with our Republic of Korea allies, our Japanese allies, and other friends and partners in the region. So overall, I think it's been very well received and leading to a very, very positive outcome. There were no surprises when we released the nuclear posture review in terms of our allies' perceptions. They understand our rationale. They understand why we're going forward with the supplemental capabilities that we proposed. They understand our commitment to extended deterrence and to making sure that the relationships and the security guarantees that we provide to our regional, to our regional allies and partners, are strong and remain strong. And this administration is committed to maintaining the strength of those security guarantees. Frank, you want to pick it?
No, just one more question.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Hank Gaffney. I spent 13 years on NATO nuclear weapons and another 13 years of dialogues with the Russians.
Well, I'll let you answer the DOE question.
What's the prospects of real dialogues with the Russians? I keep hearing rumors that the administration is not going to renew New START. Is that true? And what are the prospects for actual dialogues with the Russians?
Look, that is an excellent question. The prospect for dialogue with the Russians, we are certainly open to dialogue with the Russians. Whether New START is renewed or not renewed is an issue that has not been decided within the administration. It's one of any number of issues that we are looking at in the broader context of where are we going with the arms control dialogue with Russia. Russia, as you know, and as I alluded to in my remarks, has for years been in violation of the INF Treaty. That says something about Russian behavior. Russia has also been in violation of some other treaty commitments. What does that mean? Do the Russians get to sort of pick and choose which treaties and which obligations they wish to comply with and which they don't? This is all part and parcel of a sort of a broader dialogue that we're having and a broader examination within the administration as to where do we go? What does the future of arms control look like? And more broadly, what is the future of our relationship with Russia? We would like, of course, for that the future of that relationship to be put on a more positive trajectory. It has not been on a positive trajectory, primarily because of the actions that the Russians have taken and the behavior that we've witnessed in other areas, whether it's with respect to Crimea, Ukraine, whether it's respect to Syria, whether it's with respect to other types of behavior and activities the Russians are engaged in. The Russians are engaged in a major military modernization program, completely rescoping and replacing a lot of their nuclear systems, both at the strategic level and the non-strategic level. What does that mean in terms of our ability to engage in dialogue with the Russians going forward? What does it mean for arms control? It's an excellent question. I would say we are certainly not opposed to talking to the Russians about where we go in the future. Unfortunately, Russia's behavior doesn't give a real cause for optimism, in my view, that we'll be able to get where we'd like to get with Russia down the road in connection with future arms control agreements. That doesn't mean we won't consider trying. It just means we're in a situation today based on Russian behavior where I think it has become increasingly difficult to move the needle in a positive direction on that dialogue. Hopefully that will change. We haven't given up.
So it sounds like a big new arms race.
Oh, no, not at all. It takes two to race. As I said previously, we're not interested in matching the Russians system for system. The Russians have been developing an incredible amount of new nuclear weapon systems, including the novel nuclear systems that President Putin unveiled to great fanfare a number of months ago. The Russians are doing a number of things we are not simply not doing. What we're trying to do is we're trying to take some modest steps in order to lower Russia's sense of confidence that what they're doing gives them some kind of exploitable advantage that could lead to a miscalculation on their part that we absolutely don't want to see.
Secretary Trachtenberg, thank you so much for coming today. I think you did a wonderful job providing us an overview of the Trump administration's extended deterrence policy. You've given us a lot to chew on for the panel. So thanks again for coming to Brookings.
My pleasure.
Please join me in thanking Secretary Trachtenberg.
Thanks so much.
Can I ask the panelists now to take their seats? And we'll start the panel discussion. Well, colleagues, we have an excellent panel of experts to further explore some of the issues that Secretary Trachtenberg raised in his keynote address. I call them the Extended Deterrence Dream Team. We have Elaine Bunn, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear and Missile Defense
policy during the Obama administration. In addition to her time as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, she has over 30 years of experience working extended deterrence issues, both in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, but also at National Defense University. Next, we have Kathleen Hicks, who currently serves as Senior Vice President, Henry A. Kissinger Chair, and Director of the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Prior to joining CSIS in 2014, she had a long career at the Department of Defense, including service as both Principal Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and Deputy Undersecretary for Strategy, Plans, and Forces. And last, but certainly not least, we have John Wolfstahl, who currently directs the Nuclear Crisis Group, an independent project of Global Zero. John has had a long career working arms control and nonproliferation issues, including service as Senior Director for Arms Control and Nonproliferation at the National Security Council, a Senior Advisor to Vice President Biden, and in various positions at the U.S. Department of Energy. So here's how we're going to proceed. I'm going to ask the panel three or four questions, and then we will turn it over to you for questions that you may have. And why don't we start the questioning with Elaine? Elaine, you have worked extended deterrence issues for Democrat and Republican administrations. So you have a pretty good feel on kind of where we are, where the allies are. So at the 20,000-foot level, how is the Trump administration doing on extended deterrence? Are the allies more assured, less assured, or are we about the same as always?
I would say that this administration's overall policy on extended deterrence is a bit confused and unclear, confusing and unclear. And I say that because I very much appreciate what Dave Trachtenberg had to say, and he was especially about being very supportive of our alliances. I think, among other things, though, what his remarks brings out, what they highlight, is the chasm between what international security experts and specialists who are appointees in the administration say and what comes out of the president's mouth. So it's, you know, all the official documents that Dave cited, the National Security Strategy, the National Defense Strategy, the Nuclear Posture Review, the Missile Defense Review, they all say, oh, it's called the right things, the traditional things about alliances. They really do capture our intent to assure allies that we will have common approaches to common challenges as much as that can be possible in democracies, so we'll have common approaches. They really could have been, those documents could have been written by any administration in the last 70 years. But those very carefully nuanced documents don't seem to reflect the, I'll call it disdain, that comes out of the president about allies and alliances. In fact, early in this administration, I debated with myself. I asked myself, do Trump tweets count as U.S. declaratory policy? And I wanted to think, no, they don't. That's just kind of off the cuff, from the gut. But the more I think about it and the way it's perceived by allies, just as surely as Lincoln at Gettysburg or FDR making fireside chats on the radio are U.S. declaratory policy, so are the president's tweets. And so I think the litany of issues that have come out of those has caused uncertainty with allies. And besides that, those very unexpected sometimes tweets or statements at rallies are more media-worthy, get a lot more press than the one-time, very careful, very nuanced, read dull and boring documents that come out of every administration. So they reverberate around the world a lot more.
Great. Kath, John, would you like to add on this?
I think that was beautifully stated, and so I just always marvel at how polite we are. So politely stated. I would just add to further Elaine's points that she's already made, we have a tendency, particularly in Washington, to think capital to capital, that we can reassure leader to leader, secretary to cabinet secretary, working level to working level. And that surely goes on for all the reasons that Elaine has said, because there are documents that officials in the administration can point to. There are good relationships that people have, longstanding or new. There are eager allies who want to hear these reassuring messages and translate them up. But we and our allies live in democracies with their open societies. Messages carry, and the messages of a president carry to domestic audiences here and abroad. And that reverberates. That has a whole other set of reverberations that we're not capturing well when we try to talk about these official documents or the hard work that's going on behind the scenes. And I think that's really starting to wash over and take over the way in which alliance relationships, to include with regard to extended deterrence, are actually evolving.
John?
Just a brief point. I agree with everything that's been said, but I don't think our problem with extended deterrence is just about the president's tweets. You don't start trade wars with your allies. You don't pull out of agreements that have been carefully negotiated with your allies and leave them in the lurch. So it's not just a question of declaratory policy and intent. Extended reassurance and allied management, but broad suite of economic, political, personal, cultural relationships, all of which are being diminished and undermined by the president, but the administration's policies. No doubt, and I agree, the documents repeat words that we believe and that the deep state, for lack of a better word, is trying to hold on to. But it's not just the person at the top. We do have a broad set of policies put in place by this administration that undermine American credibility, and that affects our ability to reassure and deter.
Great. Thanks for that. Kath, let's go next to you. You recently served as a commissioner on the National Defense Strategy Commission, and that group raised some serious concerns that the U.S. was losing its conventional military advantage, especially with regards to Russia and China. That said, my question to you is as follows. Do you believe that the United States is indeed losing its conventional military edge against Russia and China? And if so, how do we reassure our allies that we will meet our extended deterrence commitments in a security environment where the United States no longer has overwhelming conventional superiority like we had in the 1990s and 2000s?
Sure. I think the simplest way I can frame this issue is when people talk about defense in the United States, we tend to talk about more or less, more money, less money, bigger force, lesser force, size. The reality of the situation today is much less about that than about how we are spending and how we are modernizing. And here you intersect the issue of how the Chinese and Russians are themselves adapting to the world as it is. And they are starting to pace us in many significant areas. So you can think about things that will feel very familiar, like cyberspace, where I think most people recognize that the Russians and Chinese are advancing pretty significantly. Space, very concerning. We, of course, know, Dave Trachtenberg did a nice job of highlighting what they're doing in the nuclear space, particularly Russia. But what we're starting to see is that they are gaining capability, sort of, if you will, niche or specific capability advantages that make it very difficult for the United States, increasingly difficult for the United States to deter and assure effectively in these forward regions where our allies live and where the extended deterrence question comes into play. So the United States is really challenged to adapt itself, alter itself in terms of how it operates in the future, rather than just focus on recapitalizing, if you will, overstating the case a bit, the 20th century U.S. military that we've all become used to and love. And so that really is a challenge not just to the Defense Department, but to the industrial base, to Congress, and to the White House to really think about how we innovate in this next century, when so much of the challenge set is about how we strengthen ourselves in the commercial sector, how we ensure we have, for example, cyber defense through critical infrastructure, whether it's our election systems, our defense industrial base, our energy sector, et cetera, and we get a population that's educated, diversified demographically to be as innovative today, excuse me, in the future as it is today, while we know the Chinese and others are investing in things like AI, et cetera. So that's a very broad brush way of saying that we have these regional challenges playing out in both the Russia case and the China case. They are a bit different, but they have some common characteristics centered around missile capabilities, jamming capabilities, and the ability or the seeking of keeping the United States from being able to get into a region, take down air defense, which is our traditional mode, and have superiority of the air, land, and sea.
Great. John, Elaine, anything you'd like to add?
I think that's exactly right, because, I mean, we talk about extended deterrence. People think it means extended nuclear deterrence. I agree with both of you. Extended deterrence is much more than that. And besides, I mean, there's what we do for allies, and then there's what they do, and then what we do together. And so all of it matters. All of it matters for these alliance relationships.
Great. John, let's go to you next. John, you've been a strong advocate of the United States adopting a no first use of nuclear weapons declaratory policy. From your perspective, one, why do you believe the United States should do this? Two, why is now the right time? And three, how do you bring the allies on board? You and I have both worked this issue with the allies, and you know that the allies have been very, very reluctant to have the United States adopt such a policy. So can you kind of provide us a little insight?
Sure. Happy to, Frank, and thanks for having me and putting me on the dream team. I'm the bench player here. So I think no first use has to be in the mix as part of the discussion. Obviously, you have to weigh the costs of adopting that policy, and there are costs, and the benefits that you gain. In my mind, I look at the number one threat facing the United States and our allies as the potential use of nuclear weapons, not just deliberate, but also accidental. And I think we tend to discount the inherent systemic risks of maintaining our forward deployed and our first use nuclear policy. We sort of bake it into the system. But there are real risks there, right? I mean, we have forward-deployed weapons. Those are security challenges. There's a crisis instability challenge that we add to. Yes, Russia has a role to play in that, but it takes two to dance, and they look at us and are worried about what we might do first. And so I worry about maintaining very quick-use, hair-trigger postures where the Russians and we both have to worry about nuclear preemption. That shortens the decision timeline, and especially if we're going into a post-INF world, I worry about that. So anything I can find that will help raise the nuclear threshold, reduce the risk of nuclear weapons, to me should be on the table. It's also not clear to me, given the work, and we all have experience here, we tend to say, oh, well, our threatening first use really deters the Russians and Chinese from doing that. I think we need to unpack that very carefully. We believe it to be true because we believe it to be true. But there isn't a lot of evidence that actually says the Russians are ready to attack us, but it's only because we threaten the first use of nuclear weapons that they don't. It's because of our conventional advantages. It's exactly what David Trachtenberg said. The Russians know they can't match us conventionally, which is why they have to threaten first use. Why then do we have to threaten first use? That doesn't make sense to me. We are trying, in fact, we make it easier for the Russians to threaten first use by doing something we ourselves don't need to do. I think the essential question that you ask here is, how do you get the allies on board? Can you get the allies on board? Because we all agree extended deterrence and reassurance is a critical part of alliance management. I think it depends on who you're talking to in the alliance system. If Kath or Elaine or you go and talk to the defense ministry in Germany, in Japan, in France, they'll say, of course, you have to maintain your current nuclear posture. Politically, it'd be a nightmare if we changed it, and you know we want to keep the Russians guessing. You talk to the foreign ministry. You talk to the people that focus on arms control, the NATO relationship more broadly, the political actors. They're more open to that, and I think part of the challenge here is I talk to my community, you talk to your community. We need to actually force these communities to interact with each other, because you can't have a sustainable alliance policy if the publics in these countries oppose U.S. nuclear policy, oppose forward deployment of nuclear weapons, and we say we don't care what you think, we're going to keep doing this anyway. We have to constantly reexamine, is there a benefit here? And if they outweigh the cost, then we should maintain it. But in my estimation, the costs far outweigh the benefits that we get by threatening first use.
Elaine, Kef?
I totally agree that it depends on who you talk with in allied countries. And when I hear somebody say, well, this country thinks, or our allies think, I go, no, tell me who,
yeah, right.
Tell me exactly, or no. But having been involved in dialogues, extended deterrence dialogues with allies, NATO, yes, but also Japan, South Korea, extended deterrence dialogues that are both, that are co-chaired by the Foreign Ministry and the Defense Ministry, for instance, I think there's, it's too simple to say it's defense versus foreign ministry. I don't think that's right. I think it's the deeper one gets into these really hard issues, the grayer it is. And so, I mean, I agree with you that there's no data, there's no proof that not having a no first use policy is good for deterrence. There's no proof that having one is good for reducing accidents or miscalculations either. So, I mean, it's the, it is having looked and relooked at this, Clinton administration, George W. Bush administration, Obama administration, it is, after looking at it very carefully and talking with a range of people in allied countries, it has come out so far that no, not a good idea for now. So I guess I don't say never. I would be a little more comfortable if you would say, what about a no first use of any kind of nuclear, chemical, bio? There are threats that we don't have biological weapons. So how do you deter really bad things from happening to our allies? Not just to us, but to our mm-hmm. allies, without that possibility, ambiguity. I'm not there yet, John.
Kef?
Yeah, I'm closer to Elaine. I'm not there yet. I think it's a possibility on the agenda for nonproliferation. I'd put it lower down in my priorities than things like, you know, the adding on the tactical or non-strategic nuclear weapons for the United States. There are other things I would go at first, certainly making sure we can get a new start. There are a lot of areas I would go to first before I would think that it's appropriate to really get back to this issue of whether our lack of a or our calculated ambiguity pledge or approach is wrong. I agree very much with Elaine that a lot of the rationale in the defense world has been around chembio in particular, and bio being the more threatening of the two, where the U.S., of course, as a non-pro priority, stays out of those types of weapons. And thus we have nuclear as the sort of the fallback. There is some, you know, debated evidence that in the case of Iraq, that there was a view that Saddam Hussein was deterred in the 1990-91 period by the fear that the United States might bring nuclear weapons to bear under the first Bush administration. That's really the only case we have with some evidence that the fact that the U.S. had this calculated ambiguity policy created pause of action in an adversary. That's not Russia and China. I do think you have to tailor. But, you know, it's more than nothing.
Great. Well, let me pose one final question to the panel, and it's a two-part question. First, what steps do you believe the United States needs to take, both political and military, to enhance extended deterrence going forward? And here's the $10,000 question. What are the potential consequences if allies begin to lose faith in U.S. extended deterrence? So, who'd like to start? John?
Sure. I think the number one fundamental thing we need to do is have conventional military forces that are credible and capable of deterring attack and defeating an adversary. That prevents wars. We should have weapons that are credibly usable that don't bring in these questions about whether or not we would or wouldn't, and we need to make that clear. That requires investments, and quite frankly, those are investments that are trade-offs between the nuclear and the conventional world. I think the second thing is we need a political leadership, including a president, who speak unwaveringly about our unwavering commitments. I questioned, you know, in my mind, I wondered whether Secretary Trachtenberg knows the meaning of the word unwavering, because we have sent mixed messages, both by the president and in other actions, and so I think that has to change. And I think we have to get back to a place where we're talking about the broader connections between the United States and our allies, not just on the military front, but military is clearly a key part of that, but on the economic, on the political, on the cultural, on the trade, on the immigration. All of those are parts of that that construct.
Kath?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the strategic challenge the United States faces today, and it's different than it's faced in the past, it will continue to evolve. But there is a constancy to the fact that one of the largest asymmetric advantages we have is our alliance network. It's a force multiplier, literally. It's an economic multiplier, literally. It creates the ability to generate pressure, whether you agree, for instance, with the JCPOA or not. You can look at how the United States was able to bring China and Russia even to the table alongside allies and partners to create international action. You can take that model and apply it to something you prefer if you don't like that particular use. But the reality is we have successfully used it. North Korea sanctions, you can think of other things. That is a huge advantage to throw away. And to throw it away over loose language, more tactical challenges, which are real, from burden sharing to trade concerns. They're real concerns, but they need to be nested in a larger strategic vision. And if, in fact, the national security strategy and national defense strategy of the United States are going to frame themselves around these major competitions of the future, that is the best card we have to play, other than our own domestic solvency, which I would just add, I hope very much we find. And so that's my underlying view. In terms of the list of horribles that could happen, you asked about, I worry for a living, so I could have many. I'll try to limit myself here. Obviously, there is the concern about proliferation of nuclear weapons to these states. You can take from further proliferation, probably most notably in the Middle East is an area. But you can think of Asia. You can think of Europe, probably to a somewhat lesser extent. That's a real concern because it's fewer, you know, the more and more countries with fewer controls creates a lot of concern about use. You can also think about sort of classic balancing bandwagoning issues where if the United States is not a reliable partner, is not perceived to be a reliable partner, people look for other partners. This goes back to my first point. So you could see realignments in regions where the U.S. loses ground because other partners or new partnerships develop that weren't there before. And I'll pause there.
Okay. Elaine.
I just want to footstomp something Kath said, which is that we don't have alliances out of the goodness of our hearts. We have them because they're in U.S. interest to have them. Going forward, I agree. Goodness, I agree with John. I agree with Kath. What else is there to say? I do think that continuing, I mean, there is no such thing as too much dialogue and consultation with your allies. There's no such thing. The kind of extended deterrence dialogues that did not exist in Asia, in Northeast Asia, before 2010, those need to be continued and deepened and strengthened. We need to constantly be working as allies, whether it's in Europe or in Asia, to look at, I mean, the basics. It's who are we worried about? What are we worried about they're doing? And together, how do we deal with it? And some of that is things an ally will do. Some of that are things we hope they will rely on us to do, the nuclear end of things. And then all the things in the middle that we do together.
Great. So, well, thanks so much. We're going to turn it over to the audience for questions. I have only two requests. One, that you identify yourself and your affiliation. And two, you ask a question. We have microphones coming around. Why don't we start right here? And we'll take three questions and then come back to the panel.
Tom Countryman, Arms Control Association. I should have asked this to the undersecretary, but it's a sincere question, not a rhetorical one. He pointed out that strategic ambiguity means that we won't say what we'll do, but we may use nuclear weapons in the event of extreme circumstances of an attack upon an ally. The Russians say they will not use nuclear weapons first, except in the extreme circumstance that their national existence is threatened. How should I, whether I'm in this administration or a different one, or just talking to people who are not Russians or Americans, explain that U.S. Ambiguity is beneficial and Russian ambiguity is evil?
Go right there.
My name is Derek Boyd. The Undersecretary emphasized that missile defense was going to be an important part of extended deterrence. And I was wondering how he envisaged this working. I mean, is the missile defense to defend the United States so that it feels secure in protecting the Allies, or is it missile defense which is going to protect the Allies themselves locally?
Great. And one last one right there.
Jeremiah Rosman with the Association of the U.S. Army. I wanted to ask a question about extended deterrence against threshold, below threshold of conflict or gray zone attacks against allies.
Who'd like to start?
I can start as long as I can turn to Elaine on the missile defense question.
If only we had people here who knew about missile defense.
As the former DASD for missile defense and many other things. So on strategic ambiguity, I'm not sure I'm with you on the premise of the question. I don't exist in a world in which I see one as inherently good and one is inherently bad. I think they're, of course, interactive. And so I think that's kind of helps you explain why we are where we are, which is this is part of why you need continuing dialogue and progress with the Russians in order to get to a point of trust where we feel like we're at a place where both sides can start to talk differently about this approach if you're going to move forward on U.S. shifts in U.S. no first use policy. I do want to say, because it did not come up, but your question hints at it, the nuclear posture review of this administration took pains to add language that is thoroughly confusing, in my opinion, on calculated ambiguity. So that is to say, Dave Trachtenberg's point about the consistency of no first use as a U.S. policy, absolutely true. But the NPR in this administration added language, which causes one to wonder why. Were they trying to point to extended circumstances in which nuclear weapons can be used? They say no when asked that, but it worries me that they did that, because it is a shift in position, again, if you're trying to read the, you know, Talmudic understandings of the United States. Gray zone, I'm very glad you asked about that. I meant to mention it. I do a lot of work on gray zone issues, and I think the United States is deeply challenged both at home, but certainly in terms of how it's thinking through and resourcing to integrated toolkits that go at the types of threats that, for instance, the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians can put forward. So that means things like energy coercion in the case of Russia. It means political and economic coercion in the case of, in particular, Russia and China. And that requires you to have capable integrated national security policy problem right now, but also a continuing problem in the United States. The same basic challenges that have been put forward from the 9/11 Commission, the Bjongol Water Nichols efforts that we undertook at CSIS in the late 2000s, and you can think of the Project on National Security Reform. We've had many, many, many outside studies that have made clear that the U.S. government does not integrate its toolkit well, does not leverage non-military tools well, and much of the response on gray zone challenges is beyond the Defense Department and the military, and we are rhetorically in the right place. The NSS and NDS say the right things. Very little action happening there. A lot of things to be concerned about.
Elaine?
Missile defense importance of it for extended deterrence, and do we mean defense of the U.S. or defense of the allies? Both. And this is not, yes, Dave Trachtenberg said it, but I think this, I could have said this in the Obama administration, that, for instance, let me give you for instance, South Korea worried that if North Korea had an ICBM capability that could reach the U.S., that then the U.S. would not come to South Korea's defense. And so there are several things that we did to try to say, no, not true. First, you know, we went and took them to a site of our missile defense and said, okay, this is, yes, it protects the U.S., but we're trying to make sure, one, that North Korea, not Russia or China, but North Korea can't hold the U.S. at risk, and that's why this missile defense. But also remember that the U.S. has been at risk from far more ballistic missiles in its history with allies than we ever will be with North Korea. And still, we extended deterrence to allies. I mean, think about Russia, think about, goodness, Soviet Union had many more, and we still were extending deterrence to our NATO allies. The part about regional missile defense, though, for allies and for U.S. in regions has to do with, well, one, allies not feeling, especially allies who are reluctant to have their own even conventional strike capabilities, like Japan. It allows them to do something so that they aren't just sitting ducks for the cheap shots. I think it's reassuring to their publics that there's something that can be done, and the U.S. can come to their defense. And part of the regional missile defense is also that we can take forces that may be someplace else if there's a problem in a certain region and flow them to that region to help defend our ally in the face of adversaries who have ballistic missiles to try to keep us out. And so it is both the defense of the homeland and the missile defense for the regions that can play a part in extended deterrence.
John?
Yeah, I'll take a bite of two questions. The first, Tom's on ambiguity. I mean, essentially what U.S. policy is saying is we can control escalation, we can go up the ladder, and you can't. That we believe we can dominate that escalation and control it, and that the Russians won't be able to do that. And the Russians believe the exact opposite, that they can control escalation and that we can't. And the reality is that neither of us can have any confidence that we can control escalation, which is why you end up in the 1950s and 60s with 35,000 nuclear weapons each in every conceivable form, including landmines and underwater mines with frogmen. A nuclear war cannot be won and should never be fought. That's the basis for stability and security. So I think, in fact, our policy and the Russian policy, they're both illogical. I understand why we have them. I understand the desire that is embodying them, but I don't think they make sense. And in a conflict, I think they're not additive to our security. On the missile defense side, Elaine, you're right in terms of what I think David meant to say about regional and, you know, you can do things. But inherent in his argument, it really did worry me, because he's basically saying, don't worry, we'll protect ourselves. A country can't use nuclear weapons against us, and that will improve our freedom of action. But what the Russians hear is, wow, you're no longer into mutual vulnerability, which they worry about a lot when we pulled out of the ABM treaty and as we're expanding missile defenses and as we're gearing missile defenses more towards Russia. That has an impact on how they respond. The net assessment on that, in my view, is not very positive. And our allies eventually will hear, oh, I mean, I understand the desire to say, look, don't worry, we're protected, we'll get you.
Against North Korea.
Well, but that's not, in your case, you're talking North Korea. He was talking about Russia and China. I mean, I think we can agree that there's confusion in the Trump administration missile defense policy. His view was missile defense expands and enhances extended deterrence. Inherent in that argument is that we will be protected so that we can go and defeat the adversary over there. I understand that desire. That's right in the context when you have strategic stability with Russia and when there is a sense of mutual vulnerability. But as that erodes, I think that's more problematic than we are giving attention to and one that we have to spend more time working on.
And John, what I would argue is it kind of goes back to the point that Elaine mentioned a little bit earlier. If you look at the missile defense review, it clearly states that we will rely on nuclear deterrence to deal with Russia and China. But if you actually look at the president's statement at the Pentagon
right.
on the missile defense review, he said, we will develop a system that will shoot down any missile, any place,
anytime. Yeah.
So we've got a bit of a
disconnect.
Disconnect, yeah. Yes.
That's right.
Let's take another round of questions. Right there.
Hi, Jessica Bland from the British Embassy. Thank you for your comments, particularly around the importance of messaging with allies. And one of the comments you kind of put in there was about burden sharing. One of the concerns that's come up recently has been around this cost plus 50 potential demand for U.S. basing overseas in allied countries. My question is more regarding what your thoughts on whether, one, that's likely to actually be implemented, sort of the likelihood of it, and two, is there anything that allies can do to explain why it's important for the U.S. to be there? It's not just for allies' benefits, but for the U.S. benefits.
Hi, Carolyn DeRoster, National Defense University. My question is specific to NATO, and as NATO is facing diverging priorities, some by force of geography, others by domestic political factors, what role can the U.S. play, and what does the alliance writ large have to do with its deterrent policy as it's facing this increased rhetoric from Vladimir Putin in the media regarding the lower threshold for use of nuclear weapons? What can the alliance communicate, and how can the U.S. help shape that communication?
Let's go right there.
Hi, Charlie Simpson, also British Embassy. You spoke earlier a little bit about non-nuclear deterrence. Specifically with regards to hypersonics, something that's been identified by the US government as a major threat, specifically to restricting the freedom of movement of carriers in the Pacific. How do you deter that threat, specifically when you can't mutually assure destruction between the two sides?
Great. Who would like to start?
What can NATO say with regard to the rhetoric, the Putin rhetoric? Constancy in saying basically what we came to in the 2016 Warsaw Summit statement, which was a very clear, and it was very much aimed at Russia, and it took about 9 months to negotiate that statement, but I think it bears repetition, which is that to point out that any use of nuclear weapons would fundamentally change the nature of a conflict. You know, high, low, a little bit, not a little. It would fundamentally change the nature of a conflict. And I think that's a theme that NATO needs to just continually, in a united way, say.
John.
Yeah, it gets to the same point. I mean, if you were to tell me what our deterrence posture and where our defense lines are with Russia and this administration, I couldn't tell you. I mean, I can read the documents, but I don't know what President Trump would do and wouldn't do, and I think there's a lot of reason to be concerned about what he would be willing to do in a time of crisis. I think the NATO alliance has to maintain the vocal nature of our deterrent statements until the U.S. can get its act together, whether that's under this administration or a replacement. And I think it does have to get to this fundamental basis that any use of nuclear weapons is unacceptable, opens up the nuclear response option, which is a credible thing for NATO to say, which is, again, why I think no first use is part of this discussion. I think it lacks credibility to say we will initiate a nuclear war with a nuclear power. What I want to make sure we have the ability to do is to defeat any power on a conventional basis. If they want to cross the nuclear threshold and take on the responsibility and the consequence of that, we don't want that, but we're prepared to respond to that, and that's credible. So I think we have to be thinking in that context.
Yeah.
I'll take the other two. So cost plus 50, I never, ever discount that something that the president says won't happen. but I think what would create a cost plus 50 reality is if there's an ally who agrees to cost plus 50. I cannot think of an ally who would agree to cost plus 50. And my favorite example, which my colleague Alice Friend always points to, is Djibouti. I think the Djiboutans would be very happy to work with the Chinese at something less than cost plus 50 when we attempt to charge them for our presence there at plus 50%, which is what cost plus 50 is. So I don't think it's a reality. The president has, or the administration has, attempted to clarify that the president was talking about the Pacific when he said that, not about Europe. The only way I can interpret that is because there are active negotiations right now about U.S.-South Korean cost-sharing going on, and perhaps that was the context in which it was occurring. So I think more at risk in the near term is how the U.S. renegotiate, what the U.S. is willing to put on the table. I should say more explicitly what the president is willing to put on the table with regard to extended U.S. presence and capabilities on the Korean Peninsula and what the cost arrangement is around that. How can the U.S. then, related to it, you asked, how can the U.S. express itself better in this? I mean, a thousand ways to Sunday. The United States has had trouble being strategic about this issue across the aisle and for decades. In the 1980s, I remember, and the early 90s, dealing with sort of, really the early 90s, dealing with sort of the left in the United States focused on the peace dividend coming out of the Cold War, and a big part of that was bringing the troops home, if you will, and that the dollars would flow back. When you go fast forward, I mean, there's many other examples, but fast forward to the removal or the reduction of U.S. Army forces in Europe under the Obama administration, which I was deeply involved in those decisions and discussions, and there was a very strong congressional push in the United States for the to make sure that the forces didn't, as we reduced the size of the army after Afghanistan, that we weren't pulling those primarily from districts in the United States. The same thing, of course, plays out in the UK. Has had the same problem. The Germans have had the same problem. So anytime you have a force, if you will, forward outside of your nation, there is this push to bring it back in because it's looked at as a gain for the local population. We just simply have to be more strategic about that, and we have a lot of work to do on the defense side to, and particularly those in uniform who are so credible on these issues, to help to explain the issue. And we've got to get members of Congress to stop looking, which I actually think is weirdly, perversely kind of happening because the president has made it so crass almost now that you see folks on the left and the right starting to reevaluate how we talk about this. But it is a real challenge in the United States. And a similar thing happens around, of course, the 2% debate, which has overcome all rational conversation and capability development, where we have a lot of problems as an alliance. And those are real problems, but they're not really about 2% fundamentally. Hypersonics. Hypersonic systems, I should say. Fundamentally, this goes to the bigger issue on where is the department going. The fundamental major gap in the department right now is it has rhetoric and some goals, including things like we need to be stronger ourselves in hypersonic systems and we need to be able to counter them. And it has budgets, which put money against that. And then there's this big black magic box in the middle where, in theory, one would be doing a lot of operational concept development, experimentation and exercises at scale in regions. Some of that is going on. I don't want to undersell what the department is doing. But the conclusion of the commission on which I serve, the National Defense Strategy Commission, and certainly the work I do in my job at CSIS, is trying to point repeatedly to this is where the problem is. It's not so much about how much we're spending. It's about how we're going to do it, and we have to change the way we think about the challenges in these regions. Hypersonic systems is an excellent example of how that can fundamentally change the way we think about how we operate. You spoke specifically about China, so I will say in the Pacific. So in the Pacific or anywhere else, when you're looking at new concepts, you're trying to think about how do I exploit my asymmetries and minimize my vulnerabilities. And I think there are some areas we can do that, I'll just say, where the U.S. can both bring to bear new technologies to include its own hypersonic capabilities, but also can change its deployment patterns, its reliance, for example, on undersea warfare, where we have a particular strength. That's an asymmetry for us, to balance out and put different things at risk for the Chinese that create that deterrent stable situation where they don't want to try to use them.
You know, John and Kath, both of you have raised the point on the importance of improving our conventional capabilities. I remember reading an article in the New York Times about a year or two ago And the article noted that, you know, the United States was always able during the Cold War to maintain a conventional superiority based on the technologies that we developed. But most of those technologies were developed in government labs, whether it be nuclear weapons, precision-guided weapons. But what we've seen since the late 1980s is the fact that a lot of these new technologies are now produced by the commercial sector. And therefore, the ability of the United States to kind of control that technology is limited. Indeed, if you look at some of these investments, especially in artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and a whole host of other areas, the Chinese are putting a lot more resources than the United States is towards these technologies. How do we deal with that? And what are the implications for extended deterrence?
I will be very brief so Kath can collect her better and more informed thoughts ably. I mean, I think we have to be smarter. I think we have to prioritize. And quite frankly, I think we have to avoid this desire to race and match. I mean, I think we heard the right things, but I'm hearing a lot of rhetoric from this administration. The Chinese have this, we got to get that, right? INF range systems, hyperglides, the Russians and Chinese are clearing the clock, we got to get those. Why? What's the rationale? What's the trade-off? And so the example I use is we're very concerned, rightly so, about critical infrastructure in this country and cyber, right? Our systems are potentially vulnerable, our power grid, our communications grid, right? And we're saying that in order to play defense, we're going to play offense. So our nuclear weapons, we're going to expand the mission so that we will threaten the use of nuclear weapons to deter any attack on our critical infrastructure and cyber. Great. Questions about credibility aside, that's $50 billion a year for maintaining and expanding. How much would it take to actually improve the redundancy and resiliency of our power grid, of our cyber capabilities, of our space options? That's one of the things. Now, I'm not saying that we should gut nukes to build new sets, but we have to look at those trade-offs. And it seems to me we could be doing a lot more with operational concepts, redundancy, defense in depth, as opposed to just saying, oh, well, we'll push a button and it'll be okay.
Well, John, you know, you raise a very important point. About a year ago, I had to testify before the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Russian and Chinese nuclear policy and doctrine. I spent a fair amount on Russian-Chinese policy and doctrine, but I also spent a lot of time on these asymmetric vulnerabilities and the need to work with our allies to close those asymmetric vulnerabilities. Kath?
Yeah, I mean, I go back to what I said before that, you know, our greatest strengths really, and they are strengths, are the degree to which we can continue to put forward or model ourselves in a way that attracts both our domestic population and others around the world to sort of strive for freedom, which is built into how we describe ourselves constitutionally, and to attract allies and partners who are like-minded and have the same views about rule of law, et cetera, overseas. So going back to that, what makes us highly competitive in that kind of a world to achieve those goals is igniting our private sector and working effectively public-private. It is not going to be a model like the Chinese have where they have to underwrite the private sector or Chinese companies, however you want to put that, to give them state backing. It shouldn't mean we're trying to drive the Chinese economically into the ground. What it means is we're trying to enforce that there's an appropriate way to interact with your companies under the rules of the WTO, et cetera. So, what does that mean for the United States? I think it means taking what's in the national security strategy as just rhetoric, which is a national security innovation base, which is a good concept. I applaud them for putting that forward. There has been nothing done on that. I think taking a concept like that and really putting it into action, which is fundamentally about things like STEM education, investment in R&D in the universities, as well as government R&D, which needs to go in the defense budget, for instance, that was just put forward. There's a two-year jump in research and development that then just drops off again. So I think demonstrating a sustained investment in how we're going to get on top of things like AI, quantum, and I just want to add, there are many areas, but I really want to add bio, because we always we always focus on sort of the non-bio, the computing information side, and that piece of the game, if you will, both normatively, ethically, and in terms of the advance of capabilities that's happening overseas is significant, and the economic implications. So I think that's another area where the United States has some really clear advantages that it ought to be galvanizing.
Elaine, anything you'd like to add?
I mean, I think that's right. I think that making sure that you've got the seed corn for exploring and figuring out what's possible in the future, what's possible that others are doing, but what's possible for you and your allies is a key, and we do tend to stint the seed corn.
Yep.
We do that. And I think, you know, we don't know what the future is going to look like. We don't know which of these capabilities are going to manifest themselves in what ways and with what use. And, I mean, the thing about alliances is you can't say exactly what the future is going to look like, but you can say these are the folks, these are the like-minded nations that I want to work with to deal with whatever comes with the future.
Great. Well, we have time for one last round of questions. Let's start there.
Hi, Stephen Young with the External Scientists. Thanks, panel, for good answers. The 2010 Nuclear Posture Review, as you all know, said that the U.S. administration was not prepared at that point to say the sole purpose of nuclear weapons was deterrence, but said the fundamental role of nuclear weapons is deterrence, and set as a goal that the U.S. should be able to say sole purpose is what nuclear weapons are for. In January 2017, Vice President Biden gave a speech next door where he said he and the President concluded at that time the U.S. had reached that point where the U.S. should be able to say that the sole purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons is deterrence. And he added that, in his view, he couldn't imagine a scenario under which the U.S. first use of nuclear weapons would be advisable or a good choice. Does the panel agree with the President's Vice President's assessment at that time?
Right here.
Hi, Laura Kennedy, also with Arms Control Association, but since Tom's got that covered, maybe I'll say Foreign Policy for America. I wondered if you all could address China, which of course does have a no first use declared policy, and perhaps comment on are they reacting to perceived changes in U.S. and Russian policies, or are they just operating on their own trajectory in terms of their own military and nuclear modernization? Thank you.
I was interested in your comments about how we should improve. There was a number of people talking about how we should improve conventional capabilities. It does strike me, though, that in a place like Europe, which is what I'm most familiar with, even if we had the kind of force that we had there during the height of the Cold War, because of the kind of threats that we're dealing with, wouldn't really help us much. I mean, what would we have done in Crimea or, you know, other kinds of cases there where we're not looking at sort of, you know, the great Warsaw Pact hordes coming through the Fulda Gap? And I'm wondering what kind of measures we could use, or is there something we could do to deal with this kind of asymmetrical situation?
And let's take one more.
My question has to do with the renewal of the New START Treaty. And today in the paper, again, was another story about the Russian undersea multi-megaton autonomous drone. They've also got a hypersonic system they've been testing, the Avant-Garde, and this other, also a hypersonic cruise missile. Nuclear-powered cruise missile. Should we renew New START if it doesn't include those systems? Because they are clearly strategic systems.
Great. Well, let's turn to the panel for one last round. And also, please feel free to provide any kind of last comments. Elaine?
So on the Laura, on your question about China and their long standing since they first tested nuclear weapons, no first use policy, and are they considering changing it, given that U.S. and Russia don't have no first use policies? Is that?
Well, I guess they're saying more broadly. Or if you do think there are cases where they might change that no first use policy, I guess I was thinking more broadly in terms of are they adjusting deployments, developments, and so on in reaction to how they perceive U.S. and Russia. But sure, if you think there's a chance they might change no first use, I'd be interested.
I was going to say on that, I don't foresee them changing it. There was a debate in China that you could glimpse, 10 years or so ago, where they considered, the experts thought, well, Is every case is that the right policy to have or not? But it became pretty clear that the leadership had said, the debate's over, we're keeping a no first use policy. I assume they had decided that the deterrence benefits of not having a no first use policy were outweighed by their longstanding history, the what they wanted to portray to the world in the no first use policy. I do see China. Of all the things China does, its nuclear forces are about the least of my worries. I see them doing so many other things that where they are adjusting as they are gain confidence, that they are doing in space and cyber and AI in other categories. And so, yes, they're adjusting, but I don't think it's so much in their nuclear forces.
I guess I see them also in terms of say, in a post-INF world and how that regionally might affect China.
Geoff.
Well, let me just pick up on that last point. I think if I understand, Laura, what you're saying. So yeah, the Chinese are not bound by INF. I think the U.S., if we are in a semi-permanent or permanent post-INF world, then I think there's a question of what that means in terms of U.S. capability development or deployment, really, in both regions and how the Chinese then react to that. But that's a cycle one would have to then spin out, I guess, which I haven't thought thoroughly through what that would look like on the U.S. side and therefore what Chinese developments might be. My inclination would be to believe that Chinese developments, even on that cycle, would largely be in the non-nuclear space, but to be seen. I think there was a question on Global Zero, or as the 10 goal and deterrence is the only purpose of first use. Again, I'll go back to what I said before. I get paid to worry. I can think about a lot of things that worry me. And I am more comfortable having that ambiguity that you can provide to a policymaker without being able to know in the current environment we're in, where we have, in particular, the Russians highly capable and clearly adversarial in terms of many of their actions. That's where I am today. China, we covered. Conventional forces in Europe, there are definitely limitations in the Cold War, for sure, and I think you're right to point that out. In the Cold War, we never had conventional superiority in Europe. That was not the line we chose to draw. The investment that would have required would have been significant. And I don't just mean the U.S., I mean NATO. The interior line advantages that the Russians have are significant. The ability to concentrate, or their choice to concentrate forces in that way, is significant as an advantage to them. So what we are really looking to do, I think, in the U.S., alongside our NATO allies, is figure out what's the right deterrent mix. And that is a mix of conventional, frankly, nuclear, and this gray zone challenge set where the Russians are very comfortable going because they can avoid that conventional trip line. I want to say, because it hasn't come up yet, that one of the big disconnects is that the U.S. tends to talk conventionally and militarily, and that is not what the Russians are doing, right? We all know what the Russians are doing is they're thinking much more along a spectrum. And so we need to be thinking that way too, which is not simply how we might choose to fight, if you will, in a conventional deterrent way, but how the Russians might choose to escalate and when. And I think that's all the questions.
John, so, last word to you.
Great. And I know Elaine would have gotten here if she had a chance to answer all the other questions, and shame on you.
Of course we should extend New START. It is the definition.
I'm shocked, John.
It is the definition of security malpractice for this administration to have been in office for 2.5 years and not even have a position on New START. Yes, we should be seeking to capture more Russian systems. Under New START, you can declare new types. The heavy Sarmat Russian ICBM would be covered under New START. If that agreement expires in February 2021, we will have no controls over it, and there will be no controls over the number of strategic offensively deployed weapons that Russia can deploy as our modernization program works to catch up. So we want the security benefits, the predictability, the transparency that comes with that agreement for 5 years, and we want to engage Russia on their violations, on strategic stability. That has to be part of the dialogue. We are operating in the blind or with one eye, and we're about to stick a fork in our other eye, which I don't understand. On China, I think, Laura, if I understand the question, it really is China going to react to what the United States is doing across the board in terms of missile defense, if we deploy INF range systems in the region? And the answer is, of course they will. What they will do, I think, remains to be seen, and it's one of the interesting questions that's come up. A number of advocates for getting out of INF have said, get out, get out. We can do all these things with China. What's the net assessment? What does it look like in 5, 10, 20 years, all the things you worry about? I'm not sure that's to our advantage. It may be, but let's examine that before we just rush wholesale into it. Steve, I'll get back to you on the last point, which is, yes, Vice President Biden said that he and President Obama believed there was no scenario that they could envision where the United States would need to use nuclear weapons first. But they believed that that was an issue that was left to their successor because it is a presidential-level decision. And I think that's where we probably all are, which is we can give our advice in terms of what the risks and the benefits are, but the next president will have to determine whether he wants or she wants to make a change in that policy with a clear examination of what that means. And I will be bold enough to speak for everybody here saying that's not something that can be done by fiat. That's something that has to be done as part of a sustained dialogue with our allies. We're going to be doing a lot of work to repair our alliances in the post-Trump era. Assurance is about commitment and capability. We are low on commitment and we are high on capability, but coming down. We need to really bank that. But we have an opportunity as we reassert our leadership and our commitment and our will to make some adjustments and talk with allies about what that might mean for their security and how to compensate.
Great. Well, well said, John. Well, I thought that was an absolutely fantastic discussion. You know, my key takeaway from our discussion this morning is that extended deterrence is a very complicated issue. Therefore, we need to take the time to get it right. Because if we don't, it could have many negative consequences. On that note, let me thank the panelists for a fantastic discussion and thank the audience for joining us at Brookings.
Great.
Thanks so much.